The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. I'll begin today's reading with the Time magazine issue dated December 6/December 13, 2021. It features a portrait on the front cover of Francis Haugen, the whistleblower of Facebook. She is a blonde with bluish-green eyes, wearing a gray-green jacket. We see only a headshot of her in this portrait. The background is in a pale gray with Time in large block letters superimposed in whitish gray upon that gray or gray-green background, actually. As usual, the front cover of the magazine is bordered in red with an interior narrow marginal border of white. The lead story will be under the climate heading, Offshore Comes Online. Workers from New Jersey to Massachusetts are training to build the oceanic wind farms of the future, by Alejandro de la Garza. As many of New England's industrial cities fell into decline in recent decades, the wealthier residents of Martha's Vineyard, a regional center of affluence and privilege, have gotten richer, building and rebuilding beachfront mega mansions. But their good fortune has hardly benefited everyone on the island, where economic equality has run rampant. For Michael Friedman, a 55-year-old IT engineer, rising prices driven by rich residents expanding wealth have made it harder to stay and raise his family on the tree-covered Massachusetts island where he grew up. "What can you say," he says, driving past the Obama family's vineyard property in late October. "We will try to make a go of it." Now, 15 miles off the island's coast, a new green energy project is getting underway that many hope will begin to spread the wealth. In a matter of months, workers will begin erecting 837-foot-tall wind turbines for Vineyard Wind, the country's first commercial-scale offshore wind farm. When fully operational, the plant will generate 800 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 400,000 homes. More than a dozen other East Coast offshore wind projects are awaiting government approval, and the plans portend an entirely new clean energy industry, with thousands of new high-paying jobs to go along with it. But there is a catch. Hardly any U.S. workers have experience building and operating offshore turbines. Community organizations, unions, and colleges are now filling that gap, launching training programs in a broad effort to create a new American offshore wind workforce. For organizations that have plowed considerable time and money into education programs, for projects that do not yet exist, these efforts are something of a leap of faith. The same is true for the workers who are undergoing those courses, hoping that a brand new, eager to hire clean energy industry will await them on the other side. Friedman is one of those would-be wind workers. For months, he's been taking online classes for an offshore wind tech certification through ACEMV, Adult and Community Education, Martha's Vineyard, and Bristol Community College. He is taking the course partly for personal interest, though he says he would consider switching careers if the opportunity came up. But with Vineyard Wind more than a year and a half from producing power, he is far from certain that the work he and his fellow students are doing will result in a job. Offshore wind has been just over the horizon for decades, with endless legal battles grinding a previous Massachusetts venture, Cape Wind, to a halt in 2017. Things are likely to be different with Vineyard Wind. The project is located farther offshore and has not faced the same intensity of local backlash. But many, like Friedman, remain skeptical. "I will believe it when I see it," he says. Yet others are diving in. On a brisk November morning, a handful of pile drivers, Local 56 workers, shivered as they floated in the ice-cold water of Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts, for a training session. During an earlier safety lecture, one of the workers, Nick Felicia, had made a few wisecracks. Now, after the pile drivers donned bright orange ocean survival suits and slipped off a dock into the blue-gray water, he was dead serious. "Man, that water," he said, after emerging from 30 minutes in the frigid bay, during which he and his classmates had to right an overturned life raft. "I was all jokes till we got in that water." That exercise was part of a global wind organization, GWO, training program designed to prepare millwrights, iron workers, and other tradespeople for the unique challenges involved in doing their jobs at sea. Besides sea survival modules and classroom components, it includes portions on working at heights, first aid, and fire safety. "A lot of it is teaching them skills that we hope they never have to use," says Mike Burns, director of the Center for Maritime and Professional Training at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. "Practicing an emergency escape from a wind turbine is something you hope you never have to do in real life, but you're glad that you've been trained how to do it." The Academy is currently one of the only places in the U.S. where workers can get this type of training, but it may soon be offered at more locations up and down the East Coast. Labor organizations are among the largest supporters of such programs. The Eastern Atlantic States Regional Council of Carpenters, for instance, is planning to upgrade a training facility in New Jersey with a wind turbine mock-up, cranes, and other equipment. "We're in it for about $700,000, $800,000 so far," says William Spruill, the organization's executive secretary treasurer. Meanwhile, the New York State Building and Construction Trades Council is planning to increase class sizes in existing training programs to up the number of workers it can prepare for anticipated local offshore wind projects. "We are really at the very beginning, the precipice of offshore wind on the East Coast," says Union President Gary LaBarbera. And as Vineyard Wind gets underway, the Massachusetts Building Trades Council, another union, plans to set up a kind of offshore worker training pipeline, starting newer workers on the onshore portions of the project, like building electrical substations, then moving them out to sea. "That's the way you develop a stable workforce and a skilled workforce for this industry," says Union President Frank Callahan. Meanwhile, Bristol Community College, where Friedman is currently studying, is sinking $10 million into launching what it is calling the National Offshore Wind Institute. Scheduled to open in 2022, the facility will focus on training workers rather than teaching courses for college credit, and will offer programs on other aspects of the offshore wind industry, like finance and insurance. Jennifer Menard, the college's vice president of economic and business development, says her goal is to help replicate the economic investment that offshore wind spurred in cities like Cuxhaven in Germany and Hull in the UK. Facilitating such a renewal, Menard says, means stepping up investments in education to fill gaps in the current U.S. workforce. I saw what offshore wind could bring, she says. It was just an opportunity that we wanted to be ready for. Europe, where offshore wind is a long-established industry, may also offer an ideal training ground for U.S. workers. Ørsted, a Danish offshore wind giant, is bringing more than a dozen American workers to train at its European sites for months at a time. The idea, says Ørsted's head of North America operations, Mikael Mellison, is to create an elite group of workers who can in turn train more Americans as the company's U.S. projects, like a planned 700-megawatt wind farm off Rhode Island, get underway. There are a few photos within this article that I'll stop now and describe to some extent. Workers are preparing to erect new offshore wind farms along the U.S. East Coast in the coming years, and they're taught how to do their jobs at sea and trained in emergency survival techniques. This includes a trio of photographs. None is very large, but they're all in color. The first one shows a man, I believe, uniformed in the orange oceanic survival suit. He also has the rigging on for what one might use in mountain climbing, a lot of straps and hooks and other things. He is climbing a ladder. It's a steel ladder. It appears that this whole photo is taken on a raft or some kind of sea craft because there is gray water around them. And this person is not only wearing the orange suit, but has a helmet on, no gloves, however, and is wearing white shoes that look like Crocs, the plastic spongy kind of shoes. In the background, there are green trees visible in a distance, so this is some location not too far offshore. Then there's another, well, it might be the same individual, it's hard to know, but this person is actually in the water, in this murky, dark grayish water, also wearing the orange suit, the white croc-looking footwear, no gloves, blue helmet, and he's almost lounging atop the water. He has his hands on his knees, so he's slightly hunched, and he's wearing a flotation device around his neck. Then in the third of the photos is another individual, and this person I'm quite sure is different from the other two because he is not in the orange uniform, and he has facial hair, which the others appeared not to have in the photos. He's wearing safety glasses, khaki work pants, a gray T-shirt. He has lots of tattoos on his arms, and he's wearing gloves. And he is not wearing Crocs. He's wearing heavier duty work boots or work shoes. He's in some kind of a mechanical room. There are windows behind him, and he's leaning on some kind of a contraption that looks to me like a hydraulic jack, perhaps. But there are other pieces of equipment surrounding him with meters and gauges and tanks. And so he's apparently learning how to run some type of equipment or is running it. Then there's one more inset here. It's a quite small and sparse map of the East Coast running from Massachusetts down to South Carolina. So a few of the cities that are noted are Providence, Rhode Island, New York City, Philadelphia, D.C., Norfolk, Virginia, and Wilmington, North Carolina. Then there are orange blobs in the ocean next to the coast, well, almost next to the coastline of this gray, fairly plain map. And at the top, near Rhode Island and Massachusetts, is Vineyard Wind. And the heading here is the future of wind. If these potential wind energy sites are developed, Vineyard Wind could be just the beginning of massive wind power expansion along the East Coast. And the source of this map or graphic is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Returning now to the text of this article, despite this flurry of training investment, some U.S. labor leaders worry that as the country decarbonizes, an expansion of offshore wind will not provide as many jobs as its proponents hope, especially compared with the expected loss of labor-intensive fossil fuel power plant projects. David Longley, business manager of Iron Workers Local 37 in Rhode Island, is particularly concerned about the fact that many offshore wind-related jobs come from manufacturing turbine components, an industry based largely in Europe, rather than erecting and maintaining such equipment offshore. There will be a tremendous amount of hours that the American workforce will lose out on, he says. Longley wants offshore wind manufacturers like GE, which is supplying turbines to the Vineyard Wind project and makes many of its components in France, to produce turbines and similar gear domestically, a goal offshore wind developers say they support. Ørsted, for instance, has tapped local 37 iron workers to help erect a huge steel structure at the port in Providence, Rhode Island, to be used to manufacture bases for the company's offshore turbines. And despite his reservations about offshore wind, Longley says his union is committed to the green energy transition. I am not a scientist, but clearly we are getting more hurricanes. We're getting worse storms. It is getting warmer, Longley says. There's obviously something to this climate change, and it has to do with carbon emissions. So we have to do the right thing. Back on Martha's Vineyard, Miles Brucolieri, 44, is studying hard, despite his doubts about future employment. He's worked as a surfing instructor for the past two decades, but is not sure how much longer he will be able to swim the 5 daily miles such work requires. And he has been frustrated by a lack of local work opportunities with health benefits during the long off-season. You're either serving rich people in this kind of fake rich people economy, or there's not much out there, he says. At the moment, Bruce O'Leary is 11 months into Bristol Community College's two-year offshore wind education course. By the time he finishes, Vineyard Wind's offshore turbines will still be at least 6 months from producing power. Even after they go online, there's no guarantee he will be hired as a technician. But in order for offshore wind to take off in the U.S., as it has elsewhere in the world, more people like him will have to take the plunge. The opportunity came up, so I took it, Bruce O'Leary says. I don't know where it's going to lead. Moving now to the next story, more of the same. And this is under the heading Culture. And it shows a TV remote, but it's really large. It's probably 4 times the usual size of a TV remote. And it has, I don't know what they are, groundhogs or something, popping their heads up through 3 or 4 of the buttons, one of which is marked Disney, Netflix, Binge, Stan, Hulu, Prime Video, TV, HBO Max. And the heads of the 4 creatures popping up are in addition to those. The era of peak TV has given way to a new phase defined by redundancy. How much is too much television? This is by Judy Berman. And it's lengthy, so I may be abbreviating it. It is 9 in the evening, sometime during this endless post-lockdown liminal period, and I'm curled up on the sofa, clicking listlessly through streaming menus in search of my sedative of choice, dark teen dramas, when my vision starts to blur. Is Who Killed Sarah, the new high school murder show I've been meaning to watch, or Cruel Summer, The Wilds, One of Us is Lying. The screen swims. I have to shut my overwhelmed eyes. The condition is not entirely new, and though it seems to flare up only when I'm watching television, it has worsened over time, which is concerning because I'm a TV critic. It is presented in early 2019 in the form of double vision, two documentaries from Netflix and Hulu about the disastrous Fire, F-Y-R-E, festival. Since then, I've blinked through dueling originals on fashion design, Wu-Tang Clan, 9/11. Some of them are news-driven, proliferating Britney Spears docs, some seasonal, Baking Impossible, Bake Squad, Baker's Dozen, some the repetition of a micro-genre, Rich People at a Resort in HBO's The White Lotus, Rich People at a Resort in Hulu's Lesser Nine Perfect Strangers. I call this phenomena, and the new era of television more broadly, peak redundancy. Every general interest streaming service has a knockoff of every other platform's breakout title or perennial favorite. But they are not just reverse engineering one another's hits, they're also emulating one another's ever-expanding mix of content. Netflix has spent years stockpiling originals to serve every conceivable audience. Now other services that led with scripted series are dipping toes into reality and lifestyle, stand-up, sports, and more. Each has at least one prestige murder mystery, a la Big Little Lies. Food shows, a trashy reality dating show, or five. Creative competitions, newsy docs, teen dramas, children's programs, and true crime fair. What might have begun as a strategy to court cord cutters looking to replace a whole suite of cable channels has escalated into a mandate to be everything to everyone. It is exhausting. And now that franchises and other intellectual property, IP, from Star Wars to The Witcher, have proliferated on streaming services, it's contributed to my creeping sense that television is moving on from the merely overabundant era FX head John Landgraf dubbed peak TV in 2015. We may still be deluged with viewing options, many of exceptional quality, but we also have too many shows that feel interchangeable. Now the consensus among influential people in and around the industry is that we're reaching a tipping point. Peak redundancy can sustain itself for only so long before streamers start bumping against the limits of viewers' free time and disposable income. The measures they're taking to survive the inevitable contraction of the streaming landscape, from the race to acquire or create valuable IP to the competition to win over international audiences, have their promises and potential pitfalls. But for viewers allergic to both the thought of 12 monthly subscription fees and the schlock some of that money is subsidizing, a picture of the future is coming into view, and the upshot may be a TV landscape more navigable, for better and worse, than the sagging status quo. It would be hard to overstate the sea change that's taken place in TV since the mid-aughts for both creators and consumers. It's not like anybody ever thought Breaking Bad would become Breaking Bad, says Mark Johnson, who won an Oscar for Rain Man 2 decades before as an executive producer of the era-defining crime drama that yielded AMC's excellent prequel, Better Call Saul, and a gripping Netflix film, El Camino. In many ways, the trajectory of Breaking Bad, an early beneficiary of the so-called Netflix bump, or spike in audience once a show hits the streamer, has mirrored that of the TV industry at large. That story begins sometime between the launch of YouTube in 2005 and 2007, when Netflix began offering licensed streaming titles. In 2013, Netflix launched its first high-profile original series, an adaptation of the BBC political drama House of Cards, with a two-season commitment signaling that streaming could be a serious market for creators. As Netflix's CCO and since last year co-CEO, Ted Sarandos, famously said at the time, "The goal is to become HBO faster than HBO can become us." So, as HBO and other networks scrambled to develop robust streaming platforms, Netflix and its competitors, Amazon Prime Video and Hulu, built up slates of prestige programming. "You only need one signature show to become a player in the streaming space," says Ava Greenfield, a TV literary agent at ICM Partners. Amazon broke out in 2014 with Transparent, while Hulu leveled up with The Handmaid's Tale in 2017. As the competition intensified with streamers vying for dominance globally, Netflix spent billions ramping up its originals across genres and languages. Many, myself included, found this frenzy inexplicable. It all made sense by 2019. As streaming industry analyst Dan Rayburn explains, you now have large companies in the market offering very different ways to consume their video content. Studios like Warner Brothers and Disney entered the arena with decades worth of valuable IP in their vaults, from Game of Thrones to Star Wars. Competitors that did not have the archives, like Apple and Amazon, were among the richest corporations on earth. Netflix, still the only major player whose revenue comes almost entirely from streaming subscriptions, had to quickly build a library to survive, let alone maintain supremacy. Miguel Pinella, president of streaming services at AMC Networks, says this competition was originally driven by convenience, but now that virtually every major studio has its own streaming service, convenience is not a point of differentiation anymore. To make it in 2021 and beyond, streaming services must distinguish themselves in different ways. Most important is, of course, the desirability of their content. This is where the everything-to-everyone strategy seems to fly in the face of what economists call product differentiation. If Netflix has an edge on reaching every kind of customer in the world, why not do something different? Who wants to be the fifth best Netflix? Granted, studios trying to eat one another's lunches is not new. As Katie McCaffrey, a co-head of the TV literacy department at the talent agency Gersh, puts it, Where's my this right now? Has long been a common refrain among TV executives. In the 1990s, this was Friends. A generation later, Mad Men. Part of the difference now comes down to scale. The number of scripted TV shows alone has ballooned from several dozen before cable to around 500 since the late 2010s. With recent growth primarily driven by streaming. More services mean more content, and more content mean more overlap. With so many streamers pursuing the generalist strategy, viewers who subscribe to multiple services are underwriting a lot of redundant programming. Yet for all the real estate and superhero fluff, streaming TV in 2021 is no wasteland. Netflix made history in September as the first streamer to become the biggest winner at the Emmys, with the prestige dramas The Crown and The Queen's Gambit, Apple's Ted Lasso, and HBO's Max's Hacks, H-A-C-K-S, split the comedy categories with SNL. In many cases, titles or recent cases, titles on the bubble have become viable thanks to detailed data. the existence of which has driven the misguided impression that human beings with individual artistic visions are being replaced by some sentient algorithm. In reality, says Walt Disney Television Chairman of Entertainment, Dana Walden, who oversees original programming on Hulu, what an algorithm can do very successfully is make sure, once a great show is executed, that it's delivered to the right audience. The next challenge, of course, is figuring out how to keep them tuned in. Netflix is ahead of the curve in the internationalization of TV. Its most recent quarterly report claimed 142 million accounts had sampled Squid Game, with Shonda Rhimes' Bridgerton and the French crime drama Lupin in second and third place. Most other streamers are, to varying extents, following Netflix's lead. The often great results of this particular less invasive and more collaborative form of Hollywood's cultural imperialism have also expanded the worldview of stateside audiences that might once have avoided subtitles. A smorgasbord of great scripted shows from every corner of the earth is exciting news for both creators and viewers looking to escape the endless fixer-upper clones and 90s sitcom revivals that epitomize peak redundancy. But whatever its language, the best TV is now spread out among a dozen or so streaming services, each with its own subscription fee. It is like cable, but more confusing and possibly more expensive. When Lena Waithe started out in TV in the mid-aughts, opportunities to tell the kinds of stories she's passionate about, specifically ones that center black and LGBTQ characters, were limited. Yet in an expanded TV universe where, Waithe notes, there's a new mandate that does not always center whiteness all the time, the prolific writer, producer, and actor is enjoying both the volume and variety of platforms this era offers. In addition to her Showtime drama, The Chi, that's C-H-I, and BET showbiz comedy, 20s, she and Master of None creator Aziz Ansari had the freedom on Netflix to create a poignant season about her supporting character Denise's marriage. Just about every creator I spoke with agrees with Waithe that our business is in transition. Calderon Kellett's next project is Amazon's With Love, a holiday romance that follows a big Latinx family with a variety of gender identities and sexual orientations. While pitching it, she was delighted that the more I would talk to execs, the more they were like, "Oh my God, this is exactly what we need. We want it tomorrow." The long-term future of TV is shaping up to be a balance, if not a battle, between multinational corporations and singular artists, billion-dollar franchises and quirky pilots. But happily, this period of unprecedented redundancy can't last forever. Yes, in all likelihood, Netflix will continue to be the best at offering everything to everyone. But even as their platforms expand, other big streamers claim to have no interest in competing with Netflix's volume. Disney's Walden says Hulu is focused on highly curated originals. Salk says Amazon believes in targeted content strategies that actually pay off. But here I go again, relying on my own blurred vision when most within the industry take a longer view. I take great comfort in seeing that at the very heart of it, people are telling stories they really have an urgency to tell, and audiences are getting excited about them, says Gamble. And perhaps most heartening, she adds, fresh voices are being invited to join the conversation. Isn't that the only thing that's going to keep us from being bored to F-C-K-I-N-G death? That was by Judy Berman, with reporting by Mariah Espada. Time Off, Bringing Down the House by Stephanie Zakarik. Time Off opener. Possibly the best moment in Ridley Scott's Rococo a Go-Go true crime drama House of Gucci is the one in which the brash, ambitious young typist Patrizia Reggiani, in pursuit of Maurizio Gucci, the shy and charming heir to the old money leather goods empire, writes her phone number in bold strokes of lipstick on his motorbike's windshield. That's a pro move by itself, but what comes next is the killer gesture. She swipes the bullet across her lips and, without the benefit of a mirror, affects a tidy scarlet Cupid's bow in 2 seconds flat. Either gesture by itself would be memorable, but it is the seamless linking of the two, the easy swing from the inventively practical to the seductively frivolous, that is the real trapeze act. The greater part of acting is what happens between the beats, and Lady Gaga, the actor who portrays Patrizia in House of Gucci, knows just what to put in that space. No one should be surprised that Gaga is such a captivating actor, both in House of Gucci and in her breakout film, the 2018 A Star is Born. Singers often make terrific actors. They're primed for it. All singing is acting, a channeling of feelings or remembered experiences through the body, the diaphragm, the mouth. A song is emotion drawn in the air, summoned by technique. Admittedly, bringing a character to life on a stage or screen does require a somewhat different mastery of craft, and not all singers can make the leap, but the core skills are there. As an actor, Gaga is not an anomaly. She's just the latest in a long line of singers who have also given terrific screen performances. Gaga's character in House of Gucci is based on the real-life Patrizia Reggiani, a woman of modest means who fell in love with the shy, bookish Gucci scion Maurizio, played in the movie by Adam Driver as a timid charmer with a backbone of steel. After marrying into this illustrious family, Reggiani then drove a wedge through it. When her marriage to Maurizio fell apart, she hired a hitman to kill him. Her conviction in 1997 resulted in a 29-year prison sentence, although good behavior helped earn Reggiani, now 72, early release in 2016. By now you may have read that in preparation to play Patrizia in the movie's Vision, a woman who falls deeply and truly in love, only to become twisted by ambition, greed, and jealousy, Gaga employed a number of acting tricks. She spoke with an Italian accent for 6 months straight, even when not in character. She embodied a vision of Patrizia first as a house cat, then as a fox, and ultimately as a panther, ruthless to the bone. Reading about Gaga's dive into her character is great fun, but it is best to think of her M.O. not as solid acting advice, but just as another angle of her performance art, the equivalent to taking the stage in a spangled unitard and feathered wings, wider than she is tall. Gaga's approach to acting may be a method, but it has little to do with the method, drawn from a set of performance precepts first laid down by Konstantin Stanislavski in Tsarist Russia, and much later boulderized by actors who believed the path to great truth meant walking around in unwashed clothes for 3 months. In the end, trust the tale, not the teller. No matter how she got here, Gaga's performance in House of Gucci is both tremendous fun and ultimately touching, likely despite any technique rather than because of it. As far as accents go, remember, the movie set largely in Milan and its environs, where in real life most people would be speaking Italian. In House of Gucci, everyone speaks in English, often with "that's a spicy meatball" accent. So anyone looking for realism is barking up the wrong Duomo. Gaga's performance is wonderful because she is alive to every moment. Patrizia and Maurizio meet at a fancy disco party. Despite his protestations that he cannot dance, accurate as it turns out, she draws him out to the dance floor where he stands like an awkward totem while she caboodles around him. Gaga's Patrizia is a bridge and tunnel seductress working a siren spell that, with the help of a little mild stalking, will eventually make her a Gucci. Yet in her shiny dress with her eager smile and cupcake booty, she's undeniably adorable. In these early scenes, Patrizia's ambition and her guilelessness are so entwined that you cannot see where one leaves off and the other starts. She's simply a young person who wants more, without really knowing what more is. A great singer's communication skills go far beyond those of us mere mortals. Singers generally know how to move, how to put their bodies to work in a language that goes beyond words. And even if they cannot literally make eye contact with thousands of spectators at once, they're adept at creating that illusion. Frank Sinatra began his career as a heartthrob crooner, swaying at the mic like a willow embraced by the wind. No wonder women went mad for him in the 1940s. He was boyish and non-threatening, but subtly carnal, even so, with a grave, thoughtful quality that served him well in the parallel acting career he began to cultivate seriously in the 1950s. He's remarkable as the wiry, scrappy Angelo Maggio in the 1953 From Here to Eternity. It was as if the cavalier breeziness he'd brought to the song and dance comedies he made in the 40s had passed through a flame, his swoony charm galvanizing into something deeper and richer. Similarly, Doris Day, whose voice blended the best qualities of midday and dusk, may have been best known for her fizzy comedies, some as light as Dandelion Down. But she also gave some formidable dramatic performances as singer Ruth Etting in Love Me or Leave Me, 1955, and as the distraught mother of a kidnapped child in The Man Who Knew Too Much, 1956, to name just two. Sometimes when the public wants one thing from you, your unadulterated sunniness, they underestimate your capacity to reflect your light off the moon. There are, of course, singers who have failed miserably at the acting game. Look no further than Mariah Carey in Glitter, though she redeemed herself with Precious. And there are singers who might have had greater acting careers if the stars had aligned differently. In 1972, Diana Ross, one of the most compelling R&B singers of her era, gave a stark and unsettling performance in Lady Sings the Blues, a Hollywoodized account of the life of Billie Holiday. The movie has the glossy feel of studio films of its day, but as Holiday, Ross cut straight to the bone. To look into her eyes is to meet a challenge, to travel to a place where a shimmery evening gown or the most extravagant evening gardenia is not nearly enough to veil anguish. Cher, Mick Jagger, Ice Cube, Janelle Monáe, the list of singers who are also terrific actors is long, even if some have not appeared in as many movies as we might wish. With only 3 years between major films, and with a pandemic, and an inaugural performance sandwiched in, no less, Gaga may be following a path wide enough to make room for a dual singing and acting career. Her performance in A Star is Born was a kind of glissando between skill sets. As Ali, the singer who catapults from working in restaurants to selling out stadium shows, Gaga gave a performance glorious in its nakedness, stripped of her Cleopatra as showgirl stage makeup and art installation costumes, trademarks of the Lady Gaga persona, and part of what makes her so provocative as a performer. Gaga became wholly believable as the singer next door with a dream. In its unabashed maximalism, House of Gucci is a different sort of movie, as heavily embroidered as an Alessandro Michele bomber jacket. Gaga, in a strange way, both amps it up and tones it down. We see how in an early scene, the as-not-yet glamorized Patrizia. She hastily masks her embarrassment when, while meeting the intimidated Gucci pair for the first time, played by a suitably regal Jeremy Irons, she mistakes a Klimt for a Picasso. Mid-movie, a Renard in 80s shoulder pads. She manipulates her husband, who does not need much convincing, into tossing deadweight family members from the business. And by the end, she's become a blank-eyed murderer, one whose ruthlessness has blossomed from her vulnerability like a splotchy black flower. Gaga makes all the right moves, from house cat to fox to panther, but she has not unlocked any new secrets that were not already in her songbook. From verse to chorus to bridge and on to dramatic finish, the roadmap's always been there, written in the breaths between notes. Time Off Music. Independent musicians find a lifeline in NFTs by Andrew R. Chow. It is brutally hard for most musicians to make money in the streaming era. Artists get paid fractions of pennies per stream, with many struggling to find sizable audiences at all. Data from 2019 and 2020 show that 90% of streams go to the top 1% of artists. Even a moderately successful artist like Daniel Allen, whose songs got millions of plays in 2020, only received a few $100 a month from streaming, requiring him to take on jobs like mixing and mastering to pay the bills. But over the past half year, Daniel Allen has turned to a different model that allows him both economic and creative freedom. NFTs. Allen has been selling digital copies of his electronic pop songs as NFTs, non-fungible tokens, for thousands of dollars each. He spent months cultivating relationships with NFT enthusiasts, built a community of devout fans online, and then leveraged this popularity to raise 50 ETH, $140,000 on the day of trading, in a one-day crowd campaign to fund his upcoming album, Overstimulated. The campaign auctioned off 50% of Allen's share of future master royalties, with the half he's keeping a far better deal than most major label artists receive, while giving him a hefty advance and creative autonomy. With that sale and the other songs he sells individually on the NFT music platform Catalog, which does not require him to surrender his songs' actual rights, Allen says he now makes 85% of his living off NFTs. Hundreds of musicians are following Allen into this world. On Catalog, 133 artists have sold over 300 records for more than $1 million. In the collective Song Camp, dozens of musicians from across the world are forming teams to crank out music and multimedia creations. Altogether, the goal of these NFT-based musicians is not to top the charts, but to push technological bounds and carve out a living outside of a label system that has dominated the music industry for decades. I do not think this creates rich artists, Allen said. What this does is create a musical middle class. Who is spending thousands of dollars on records that used to be 99 cents on iTunes? Many of the early buyers of music NFTs are crypto enthusiasts who are financially invested in seeing these spaces succeed. But many others are simply music fans who want to show their support the way they might have previously by buying a band's t-shirt at a venue. There are more than 230 people in Allen's Discord group, an Ascendant messaging app, and 87 investors in his upcoming album, from whom Allen solicits feedback and even creative collaboration. Before, your fan base could not be in the label meetings with you, but now we all are the label together, says Halik Mall, another successful NFT musician. NFT records will likely never replace the streaming powerhouses with their ease of use. The space also has high barriers to entry, prioritizing artists who are tech savvy extroverted, and constantly releasing content. But NFTs have already started to transform the lives of artists whom the previous system was failing. For a lot of my career, I felt there was a certain type of music I had to make, but didn't connect with, Alan says. This has given me full creative control. Here are a paragraph or two from Time Off Movies, interview back to the 70s with Paul Thomas Anderson by Matthew Jacobs. Licorice Pizza, the new movie from writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson, There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread, is a shaggy love story set in California's San Fernando Valley in 1973. The protagonists are 15-year-old Gary Valentine, Cooper Hoffman, son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, a frequent Anderson collaborator, and the aimless, slightly older Alana Kane, Alana Haim of the rock sister trio Haim, H-A-I-M. Ever since I was a kid, I've been a song and dance man, a precocious Gary tells Alana, before igniting a series of schemes, having her chaperone him on the press tour for a movie he appears in, starting a waterbed company, opening a pinball store meant to win her heart. Anderson had directed several music videos for the group Haim before he cast its youngest member, who steals Licorice Pizza from seasoned Hollywood vets like Bradley Cooper, Sean Penn, and Tom Waits. Time sat down with Anderson and Haim in New York City to talk about the film, due in theaters November 26, their creative partnership, and learning to drive a massive manual U-Haul named Gertrude through the streets of Los Angeles. Question. Paul, you first met the Haim sisters because you liked their music videos, right? Anderson, I liked their music first because I heard it on the radio. It was forever. It's still one of my favorite songs. It nagged at me that there was something deeper beyond just liking their music, and it revealed itself that their mother was my favorite teacher I'd ever had when I was 7 years old. Haim, Miss Rose, the most amazing art teacher name. Anderson, I went to a school that was very strict, gray-haired ladies. This was an art teacher who looked exactly like Alana, with long, beautiful hair, who would play guitar and teach us how to paint, burned into my memory as this rainbow. Question. Essential for this film, Alana had to spend a good chunk of time driving a massive U-Haul through narrow Los Angeles streets. Did you do your own stunt driving? Haim, I did a lot. That was the only part of the script where I was like, huh? Okay, I'll probably not do that part. This is the movies, guys. Then Paul said, no, you're going to drive the truck. I named her Gertrude. Me and Gertie, we got through it together. It really was a huge part of me becoming Alana Kane because she is fearless. Anderson, but beyond that, it was, you're also going to be running through the streets in a bikini, also on the back of a motorcycle with Sean Penn. You're going to wipe out. You're also going to get into ferocious fights. Question. Your previous movies have been star-driven. Daniel Day-Lewis, Joaquin Phoenix, Adam Sandler. What can you accomplish by casting two novices that you can't with A-listers? Anderson. You can accomplish a version of time travel. Because an audience isn't bringing any baggage. They're looking at two human beings saying words that look like they just came out of their head. I think there's joy and discovery for an audience. I wonder what it was like to walk into a club of 50 people and see you two when they were 19 years old. I hope audiences can feel that way looking at the two of them. They also look like real people. Alana's face is the greatest thing you could hope for in a movie star. From one angle, she is stunningly gorgeous. Turn it an inch to the right and you're like, what's going on with her face? That is a magic recipe. Question. We see in the film Waterbeds, the legalization of pinball, the oil crisis, Joel Walks, John Peters, Lucille Ball. Anderson, in some ways, oddly, you try to write away from them. This story comes from real-life episodes that happened to my friend Gary Getzman. He was a child actor. Check. That's a terrific story. He needed to get to the Ed Sullivan Show and did not have a chaperone. So he got a burlesque dancer to take him there. That's fantastic. He started a waterbed company. That's fantastic. He started a pinball store. That's fantastic. But if a film becomes too preoccupied with bizarro culture details specific to a time, it can tip the weight too far in a direction it cannot hold. A waterbed is funny for a minute, but what is important are the kids selling the waterbeds and how the waterbed business goes bust because of a gas crisis, which puts them in a larger scope of the world. They're at the mercy of an Arab-Israeli war that has nothing to do with them, but has found its way to the valley. Question, were any of those elements particularly intriguing to you, Alana? Haim. I had never been on a waterbed before, let me tell you that. We had waterbed school. Question. Meaning? Haim. Meaning we were starting a waterbed company, and you can't start a waterbed company without knowing how to put together a waterbed with a headboard and the vinyl. You have to know what kind of seam works for the Arabian vinyl. Anderson. Years of working with Daniel Day-Lewis has taught me a few things. I said to them, essentially, if you guys don't figure out how to make a waterbed, then you're going to be pretending, so figure out how to put the waterbeds together. Question. Daniel's method ways have infiltrated you. Haim. We got it together in 8 minutes flat. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.